Connectives, appositives, anaphora, and Amenhotep. It's coming up on the Teaching Literacy Podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Teaching Literacy Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Downs, with Patrick Wells on the back end production. This is the show where we work to bridge literacy research into practice. And hey, welcome to episode 51. We are grateful to have you here. Just a reminder, the entire backlog of the show is now available on YouTube. Just one more avenue to check out the episodes. If this is your first time and you enjoy the show, I would appreciate you leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you receive this content. That will help others find the show. If this isn't your first time and you've been around a while, we'd appreciate if you share this episode with a friend or colleague that may benefit. Let's get to today's episode. You've probably heard about syntax. Maybe you've seen a slide in a presentation that showed a strand of rope labeled as syntax. Or perhaps you learned about sentence structure in school and completed assignments where you had to diagram sentences. But do we really know what syntax is, why it matters, and how to teach it? My guests today are here to do just that. Their names are Dr. Rachel Knecht and Dr. Diana Townsend. Rachel Knecht is a doctoral candidate at the University of Nevada, Reno, and Diana Townsend is a professor of literacy studies in the College of Education and Human Development at UNR. Dr. Townsend researches the academic language development of adolescent students, specifically with vocabulary comprehension and disciplinary texts, and I think you'll see how the way she talks about syntax connects really clearly with all of those. And just a note, you'll hear that I refer to Dr. Knecht in the episode as soon to be Dr. Rachel Knecht. As she'll explain the episode at the time of the recording, she was in the home stretch of her dissertation writing, so I wanted to acknowledge that within the conversation. But if you listen to this episode in May 2024 or beyond, she will have defended her dissertation, graduated, and earned the official title of doctor. So a big congrats to Dr. Rachel Knecht, and we wish her the best with her future research. Dr. Knecht and Dr. Townsend are here today to discuss a study they conducted where they partnered with a school to teach syntax to their students. This episode is just chock full of plenty of takeaways for you to think about and apply in your classroom. After the show, make sure to stick around for Jake's take on the topic. Soon-to-be Dr. Rachel Knecht and Dr. Diana Townsend, welcome to the Teaching Literacy Podcast.
Thank you so much.
Really excited to have both of you on the show today because we're talking about an area that I think a lot of folks are interested in, a lot of folks know about, but perhaps haven't seen too much of it in action. So we're discussing syntax and specifically a project that you both worked on. Before we get into it, can each of you provide an overview of your background and your research interests and how this syntax project came to be?
Yeah, awesome. So I'm Rachel. I am a PhD candidate in literacy studies at the University of Nevada, Reno. I'm also a former middle and high school English language arts teacher, which is where I actually first became interested in syntax. During my undergraduate education, I took a class called Teaching Grammar by Dr. John Austinson at Brigham Young University. This course really opened my eyes to how fun grammar and syntax are. Not only did I increase my own knowledge and awareness of syntax, but I learned how to help students improve their writing craft through playing around with grammar and syntax, which I got to apply as a teacher. And students I found were really engaged in this, which was kind of unexpected. I did not expect them to be so excited about grammar and syntax. So since then, in my doctoral program, Diana and I started to ask questions about how knowledge and awareness of syntax could support students' reading comprehension, which overlapped with previous research Diana had done on connective words. So these questions resonated with me because of my experience teaching syntax and my desire to support adolescent reading.
And I'm Diana Townsend, professor of literacy studies at the University of Nevada in Reno. Prior to academia, I was a high school English teacher. And my research as an academic always brings me back to classrooms, supporting teachers and teaching middle and high school students. I've always loved words and phrases and their histories and their morphology. My dissertation was a quasi-experimental study an approach to supporting multilingual middle schoolers with the kinds of abstract and technical words they encounter in school. My research, along with decades of excellent vocabulary research, has shown us that students need multiple opportunities to learn words, multiple exposures to words in multiple contexts, multiple opportunities to personalize word meanings. And all of this has to happen in contexts in which we're authentically using the words. And so that brought me to exploring vocabulary learning and vocabulary instruction in the context of the challenging sentences that students are learning how to read and write in middle and high school classrooms. And as I got going in that line of work, Rachel came on board at UNR as a doc student, and she's been an amazing collaborator for these explorations.
Fantastic. Thanks for you both for joining us. And Rachel, your dissertation's done or very close to done, am I not mistaken?
Yeah, very close to done. I'm studying the effects of a syntax-focused reading intervention on middle grade students' reading comprehension, their syntactic knowledge. So yeah, I'm really excited to hopefully get those results and findings out there to everybody, and especially to teachers, to share what kinds of syntax-focused instruction they might use to help students' reading comprehension. I just want to echo what Diana said about in the context of really authentic and relevant texts. And that was what I tried to do with this intervention, was really embed this syntax instruction within those texts. So thank you for asking.
Yeah, well, congratulations. And we'll give you a bit of a break. But once those results are done and published and out there, we'd love to have you back on the show to discuss those results. So before we get into the project itself, I want to talk just a little bit about syntax. What is syntax? What do we know about syntax from the literature? And how does syntax connect to other areas of research like vocabulary or comprehension research?
Yeah, so I think it could be helpful to define syntax and syntactic knowledge. So I'll just start there. Syntax, simply put, is the order in which words are organized to create meaningful sentences. Syntactic knowledge, then, is the ability to comprehend and, on a deeper level, identify, manipulate, and reflect on syntax. We know that knowledge of syntax is important for reading comprehension. There's a really well-established research base that shows syntactic knowledge makes a unique contribution to reading comprehension, even after controlling for other components of reading, such as word reading, vocabulary, and memory. It may also be developmental, which is particularly important for our upper grade elementary students, where the relation between syntactic knowledge and reading comprehension becomes more direct as students move into the upper elementary grades. I think this finding is particularly interesting in light of the kinds of texts students are often asked to read in the upper elementary and secondary grades. These informational and discipline-specific texts often contain unfamiliar and dense syntactic structures that require syntactic knowledge to comprehend. And Diana can speak more to this. This kind of brings me to where syntactic knowledge and syntax and vocabulary overlap. So syntactic structures such as subordinate clauses often use abstract words to convey relationships between ideas. These words are often called connectives. We like to call them connectives. And they include words such as therefore, however, and subsequently.
And see, I find syntax fascinating because when you look at a single sentence, and we'll do this in a minute, but just being able to break it down and understand like what's really happening in the sentence, it's pretty amazing that the types of texts that we're able to support students in reading, because there can be quite a bit going on within a single sentence or even within a group of sentences. So you mentioned syntax and syntactic knowledge. There were two other key terms that I wanted to mention and discuss for a minute. The first one is metalinguistic awareness and epilinguistic awareness. Can you describe what these terms mean? Perhaps provide an example and explain why we should care about those terms as well.
Absolutely. So metalinguistic awareness is our conscious or explicit knowledge of how language works, how it's structured, how words might relate to each other, how phrases and clauses interact in a sentence. When we can explain how language works, kind of from the word level up to the sentence and discourse level, we have this meta-linguistic awareness. And teachers are often familiar with the word metacognition, right? Which means thinking about thinking or kind of above thinking. So meta-linguistic awareness is that kind of thinking about language or that above language knowledge space. So that's meta-linguistic awareness. And there is some promising research that when we support students with understanding how language works and being able to pull it apart and analyze it and think about form and function, that supports things like how they learn words. It supports their reading comprehension, and it can absolutely support them as writers. Now, epilinguistic awareness is related to using language and just kind of being able to use language and reading, writing, speaking, or listening. So I can speak in sentences. I can communicate ideas for a specific audience. But it's this implicit or tacit knowledge about how language works. So a child might say, I run to the park, and they might hear that and be like, oh, that's not how I usually use that word. I ran to the park. Now that's epilinguistic awareness. It's that, oh, like I kind of use it. I recognize in this context how I might want to use it in a way that other people have used it. And this is what's effective here. And it's just kind of this kind of automatic tacit. That would be epilinguistic awareness. But an adult might say, oh, I run to the park. That's an interesting application of turning a word like run into past tense by adding an ed suffix. But we actually need to say ran when we need past tense. And so that would be an adult applying metalinguistic awareness to that situation, really thinking about the form and function and structure of language in an explicit way. And what's really important about metalinguistic awareness, again, is when we can move kids past just being able to use the language to thinking intentionally about why a word or a sentence is being used in a certain way, why sentences are structured in a certain way. They then have tools to unpack some of the dense language they're going to see in schools. So it's a really potentially powerful pathway for supporting students' language and literacy development, especially when we're getting into those challenging literacy demands of secondary settings.
But imagine as well that it matters too for the instructor to have a sense of metalinguistic awareness, that if it's just epilinguistic, I know it feels right, but I can't describe why it feels like, that's going to be more challenging for me to effectively teach it than me understanding it, why that language is the way that it is to teach it. So that the evening after I sent out this outline to you both, you know, metalinguistic and epilinguistic awareness were both on my mind. And with my undergraduates, we were talking about reading long words. And so, you know, the peeling off method of, you know, are there prefixes I can peel off and suffixes and look at, you know, a base root word. And one of my students was like, I wish I would have had this earlier today, because the student she was working with in after school club was wanting, they were trying to read multisyllabic words, and the student was just wanting to split every word directly in the middle of the word. And she's like, I knew that wasn't quite the best way to be, you know, breaking apart these long words, but I didn't have a language or conception to explain why. And I said, you had epilinguistic awareness, but now you have metalinguistic awareness, that you understand perhaps a better way to break apart long words. And now you can scaffold that for your student as well. So circling back to syntax, you mentioned this, Rachel, that there's a lot of research correlating syntax level understanding with global comprehension as well. And that ties in really closely with text complexity. Like, you know, one of the main variables in the Lexile formula is how long or short a sentence is. And so we tend to think of text complexity, I think, in just a few different ways, like domain specific academic vocabulary or like tier three vocabulary words, or like, wow, this is a really challenging concept or background knowledge. But we tend to forget that sentences and syntax is really the backbone of what's holding a text up. So I pulled a paragraph that you both included in one of your publications. I'm going to read the paragraph, and we're going to see how well I do with some of these Egyptian names. And I did Google and YouTube how to say some of them, so we'll see if I remember. Then we're just going to talk through, okay, what are sentence level things that are happening in this paragraph that are making it challenging to read? So here we go. A famed pharaoh of the new period was Amenhotep IV, who triggered a religious revolution. Before Amenhotep's rule, Egypt was a polytheistic society that believed in many gods, the most important named Amon. But Amenhotep believed only in Aton, the sun god. Belief in only one god, monotheism, was a radical notion. To show his devotion to Aton, the pharaoh changed his name to Akhenaten. to Akhenaten. Yeah, to Akhenaten, the one who he who is loyal to Aton. Akhenaten moved his capital from Thebes, where Amon was worshipped, to Tel El Amarna. So what's going on in those sentences that make it challenging?
I mean, first, I am so impressed and also grateful that you looked up how to say those, because I don't think I've ever said these out loud. And I feel like I need to go back and talk to our sixth grade social studies teacher who we collaborated with and ask her how her sixth graders did with pronouncing these names. I'm sure they did great. I'm sure they knew how to do it. So I apologize if, as I'm talking about it, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce them. But one of the things that stands out is anaphora. And so I'll just start by kind of explaining what anaphora is. An anaphoric reference is a word or group of words that are used in place of another word or group of words within the same sentence or even in a different sentence. So to help us kind of remember what anaphora means, morphologically, ana is from the root meaning back, and phora is from the root meaning carry. So anaphora literally carries meaning in the text back and forth from one idea to its referent. So in this paragraph, we have, I think, one of the most challenging uses of anaphora is in the second to last sentence. It says, to show his devotion to Aton, the pharaoh changed his name to Akhenaten. So we have a pronoun here, his. It's used twice. So a pronoun is a very common use of anaphora. And then we have this noun phrase, the pharaoh, which also refers back to what the pronoun is referring to, which is Amenhotep. And we learn that Amenhotep is the pharaoh at the very beginning of this paragraph. So to comprehend this sentence, students need to be able to trace both his, the pronoun, and that noun phrase, the pharaoh, which is also an anaphoric reference, all the way back to the beginning of the paragraph. So they have to do some really, I think some pretty complex tracing there to make sure that they know who these anaphoric references are referring back to.
And that's where coherence comes in, of being able to track that flow across the text. So I'm glad you mentioned that part, because, you know, the pharaoh changed his name. You also have to track that the pharaoh is changing the pharaoh's name. And the pharaoh in and of itself is an anaphora back to Amenhotep, right? But that the pharaoh isn't changing the name of the god, that the pharaoh is changing his name. So there's a lot of things happening there with, you know, with anaphora that really can make sentences tricky. Other aspects are things like connectives and appositives. Can you describe what those are and how they work in text?
Connectives are words or phrases that show relationships between ideas in a text. Often we hear like signal words, transition words, cue words, and so those would be kind of synonymous with this idea of connectives. And connectives can show an additive relationship where extra information is being added to an initial idea. It can be a contrastive relationship where it's introducing an idea that's different, like the word but in this passage. They can also show sequence of time or steps of orders of things, first, second, third. And then they can be causal. So it can be because of this, or this happened and then this happened, or because this happened, that happened. So we get that word because in there a lot as an example of a causal, or consequently is another nice causal connective. So connectives really matter, because if you understand the idea that comes before the connective and the idea that comes after the connective, but you're not sure what function the connective itself is serving, you might be missing that an opposing idea is being set up or an additive idea is being set up. So in this particular reading, there's a pretty dense sentence. Before Amenhotep's rule, Egypt was a polytheistic society that believed in many gods, the most important named Amon. Then we get the but. So that's a cue to a reader, okay, I'm going to hear a different idea now. I'm going to hear an opposing idea now. Amenhotep believed only in Aton, the sun god. And so there's a lot of names. There's a really nice meaty word in there, polytheistic, that students have to navigate. Okay, well, what's polytheistic mean? Well, I know this but is telling me something different. And the next idea is that there's maybe only one god to believe in. So what is polytheistic? So students can actually use a connective to understand what maybe one part of a sentence is saying if they didn't quite get, when they realize, oh, this idea that I do get, it's the opposite or it's opposing to what I read before. And so they can start to actively construct meaning. It goes back to this idea of metalinguistic awareness. What is the function of but? And how can it help me understand ideas on either side of it?
Thanks for discussing connectives. Let's shift to a positives. What are a positives, and then how are a positives operating in this paragraph of text?
Yeah, so a positives are noun phrases that are placed next to another noun or noun phrase. They're usually to add more detail, information, examples about that noun or noun phrase. A positive phrases can come before or after. They can be in the middle of a sentence, but they're next to the noun or noun phrase that they're describing. So in the sentence, but Amenhotep believed only in Aton, the sun god, we have an appositive at the end. So students need to recognize that the sun god describes Aton, which is really essential because it gives you information about who that god is. And there's also a few relative clauses. So relative clauses and appositive phrases are different, but they work kind of similarly. And these relative clauses also give us more information about a noun. So they often start with who or which. So in the sentence, a famed pharaoh of the new period was Amenhotep, who triggered a religious revolution. You have that relative clause at the end that gives us some really essential information about Amenhotep. So the noun phrase, it's right after, or that the Amenhotep is right before that relative clause. So students with a history of reading difficulties may find these relative clauses particularly challenging. So it's important to pay attention to those and to scaffold those for students as well.
Appreciate you talking through those three with me of anaphora, connectives, appositives. The text I read, it obviously had long, multi-syllabic, polymorphemic words. It also had a content area that I certainly don't have a lot of background knowledge in. But those things within it as well, the anaphora, connectives, and appositives, those also, on the one hand, they make it challenging, but on the other hand, they're almost the leverage points to unlocking the understanding of it. John Strong has been on the podcast to talk about text structure. And what really stuck out to me was he said, well, text structure is really about the big ideas and the relationship between them. And I've almost started to think about syntax in the same way, where it's the small ideas, but it's the relationship between them that really where the meaning is derived from. And that's where anaphora, connectives, appositives can really help to leverage that meaning.
Yes, Jake, with these sentence features, the reading demands on students can be very intense. There can be a certain amount of working memory overload by kind of carrying the ideas or themes about a character or a detail or an event through a text. And that asks a lot of readers. And it's often these sentence level features that create these demands. But we don't ever want to underestimate the importance of vocabulary knowledge. That goes hand in hand with appositives, anaphora, connectives. So as you pointed out earlier, the word pharaoh serves as an anaphoric reference. But when students know what the word pharaoh is, the demand of tracking that anaphoric reference becomes less. So we want to help students hone in on word meanings that are essential to their comprehension, as well as help them track themes through a text or recognize how a connective might function. So we want to be thinking about, similar to how we talk about comprehension, is it strategies or knowledge? Well, it's both. When we're talking about sentence level comprehension, is it strategies for breaking down sentences, or is it knowledge of word meanings or concepts? Yes, it's both.
It's not either or, it's both and, that we have to be able to decode the long words. We have to be able to know what those words mean. And we also have to be able to track those topics throughout the sentences. So very challenging, especially when you look at the text demands of what, you know, early middle school students are expected to be reading. So let's talk about the specific project that you both were involved in. Can you describe the goals for the project, how you designed the project, and what questions you were trying to answer?
So this project began as a professional learning partnership with a K-8 school. We were working really closely with teachers, and we wanted to collaborate with them to identify what they most wanted help with and support with. And they identified academic language. We might also refer to this as school-based language, language that is relevant to school-based texts. And so teachers really wanted support with helping their students navigate the language that they would find in their content area classes. And so we identified with them sentence level features or syntax as a target for professional learning with them. Specifically, we focused on anaphora, connectives, and appositives. And as researchers, we wanted to know how this professional learning supported teachers' instruction in sentence level features. And we also wanted to explore how students navigate these challenging sentence level features.
So our first step in helping teachers think about academic language kind of at the sentence level or those sentence level features that characterize what students were seeing in their school-based texts, we decided to just ask the students themselves. And so we ran interviews, think aloud interviews on syntactic features with students. We pulled sentences from taught texts that their teachers had supported them with and untaught texts. And we asked them to tell us what they thought about those sentences and what they meant. We asked them what specific connectives meant and what it told them about relationships between ideas. We asked them about, you know, fork references and what how those were operating in sentences. Same things with the positives. What is this a positive telling us about? Why do we need this information? And so it was great. First grade through eighth graders shared their thinking with us in three rounds of interviews over about a 6-month period. At the same time as we were interviewing students in these three rounds, we were connecting with teachers and they were reflecting on what they were doing to support students with sentence level comprehension and how they thought it was going. And after every round of interviews, we shared with the teachers what we were finding about what their students were doing with those academic sentences. So it was a professional learning inquiry where teachers were thinking about their practice. We were interviewing students and sharing kind of the themes and student responses back with the teachers.
Sounds like a fantastic project to be a part of. And I'm sure having those think aloud interviews and discussing with both teachers and practitioners was, I'm sure, very, very synergistic and informative. Let's circle back to those terms, metalinguistic and epilinguistic awareness. Did you find that students were using both of those, one or the other? What did that look like and why does it matter?
So we found that students were using both metalinguistic and epilinguistic awareness. So students were using this explicit knowledge of connectives, for example, to discuss how relationships and ideas were related. They were using explicit knowledge of appositive phrases and how they work to explain how they were modifying a noun or noun phrase. So that was really exciting to hear that they were thinking in this metalinguistic way about language. We also found that they were using epilinguistic awareness. Sometimes that manifested itself in phrases like, that doesn't sound right, or this does sound right, when we maybe ask students to manipulate a sentence. What if we change this connective here to a different connective? Would that, what do you think about that? And sometimes if students didn't have that explicit or metalinguistic awareness of that connective function, then they were using that epilinguistic awareness to make sense of, that doesn't sound right to me, but they weren't able to explain why. And we kind of saw that from third grade to sixth grade, which was the grades that we focused on in one of our articles, was that the sixth graders seemed to have a more developed metalinguistic awareness of some of these sentence level features than third graders, which we might expect to see with sort of that research showing that syntactic knowledge or metalinguistic awareness of sentences is developmental.
So then you also did a maze task, which is where, you know, the students are reading a text and then every so many words, there's a word that's omitted and they have to select the word that fits best into the blank. What did the findings from the maze task show?
Absolutely. So the overall design for this project was a qualitative dominant mixed methods design. So we started with the qualitative work that we've described so far, and then we moved into the quantitative space and used all of the third and sixth graders at the school as our sample. And we created maze tasks, as you described, but we intentionally targeted connectives, anaphoric references, and appositives. So the words that were removed that students then had to choose from three options which would fit in, it might have been the referent for an anaphoric reference, or it might have been a contrastive connective, and you know, which would set up an opposition. And we gave them three different connectives to choose from. So we were really looking at, could they navigate the sentences in a text? And make decisions about what sentence level features and the functions of them would make the most sense. And so we then had all of this. We had created third and sixth grade levels, level maze tasks, and then we correlated performance on those maze tasks with their standardized test scores, which in this particular school were MAP and iReady. Now, our sample was small, and these were exploratory measures, so we're certainly interpreting our results with a lot of caution. But there were significant relationships between how students performed, statistically significant relationships with how students performed on these metalinguistic maze tasks and their overall comprehension performance. So we're excited. It's a small study and cautiously interpreting our findings, but think it's definitely a good launch pad to keep doing this work.
So then a part of this was that students were receiving explicit instruction from their teacher on sentence level features. How did the students respond to that?
Yeah, so this explicit instruction was something that in the professional learning partnership that we had developed in conjunction with these teachers, with these participating teachers. So together with the teachers, we provided some resources to help them develop this explicit instruction and sentence level features, but they really took it into their own classroom and adapted it. And so the results that we have is really from students' interviews right now is looking at how they received and perceived that explicit instruction, which I think is really worthwhile to explore is what did students think about this instruction that they received in sentence level features? And so what we learned is that students often attributed their metalinguistic awareness or their explicit sort of awareness of the sentence level features to their teacher. So students would share, oh, my teacher taught me what this connective means. This is an additive connective, meaning that it connects two ideas that are related. And they would also talk about some strategies that their teachers had taught them for breaking apart dense sentences. So for example, one of them taught them a positive phrases and kind of how they would contribute or add more detail to a noun phrase and how to identify them, taking a look at the sometimes they would be within two commas, right? If they were in the middle of a sentence falling. So they were learning how to pay attention to some of these sentence level features that really cued them into sentence parts, which they found to be helpful as we were asking them to talk about sentences in these Think Aloud interviews. So that was exciting to hear that they were drawing on that explicit instruction from their teachers.
One of the patterns we noted in the qualitative data of the interviews was when we asked students about taught sentences, sentences that had received some instruction versus non-taught sentences that we pulled from kind of similar types of texts, but the students hadn't seen them yet, the students were so confident and excited about the taught sentences. Wait, I know this. I can't wait to tell you about this. And they went on and on. So it was so great to see, so affirming for us and the teachers. The teachers were so excited that their students were able to share with us things that they had practiced and learned in their classroom. And the teachers were sometimes surprised, like, well, I wasn't sure if that student was really with me that day or I wasn't. And so this part of the study was not quantitative. So I hesitate to use the word impact, but I can't think of a better word than the teacher's instruction really had an impact on these students. And we saw that consistently across their explanations of taught sentences versus non-taught sentences.
Yeah, students just being able to explain it in such clear ways. That's like every teacher's dream, right? So then after spending this time on this project and then other things that you've been working on, what practices would you recommend for teachers to teach things like anaphora, connectives, and appositives?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the things that we've learned from this study and from other work that we've built upon here is that it's so important to explicitly teach these features and to look at the text that you're teaching and to identify what kinds of sentence level features students will most need support with. So, for example, our social studies teacher who was teaching that paragraph about Egypt that was really dense. Those were sentence level features that were important to comprehending this discipline specific text that was really important for them to know in this social studies unit on ancient civilizations. And so I think it's really important to share with teachers that, as much as kind of we have this history in teaching grammar and syntax of like daily oral language and kind of, correcting in quotation marks sentences, it's really important to do this within the context of texts that are essential to learning in your discipline, in your classrooms. And so identifying those sentence level features and then teaching them explicitly, and also giving students language to talk about these features. So that's how we, that's one of the ways we can help students develop metalinguistic awareness, is by helping them develop language to talk about sentences, to talk about syntax. And that doesn't mean necessarily that we're teaching students to use a positive, the term a positive phrase is super fluently, but exposing them to that language, teaching it explicitly, and then asking them what kinds of maybe functional labels might they apply to that a positive phrase. One that I want to share from my dissertation is I asked students to create a label to apply to a positive phrases. What's a functional label we might give that? And they called them, it's really cute, they called them super details. These phrases are like super details. They add more detail and examples to this noun or phrase. And so that was something, we had that shared language to talk about sentences. So I could use that in scaffolding with them. If I had a student that came across a dense sentence that they needed support comprehending, then I could use that language. Like, where do you see this super detail? What is this super detail? Or a positive phrase. We did use that as well. So giving students language, but also really leveraging the language that they already have to talk about these sentence level features. I think that metalinguistic awareness is really built together with your students. In addition, there's some other really great things you can do to build that awareness, like sentence manipulation activities. Sentence combining is one that's been well established as an effective practice in building student syntactic knowledge, but also things like sentence puzzles, or sentence anagrams, sometimes called, is mixing up these sentence parts, which scaffolds breaking apart sentences into meaningful phrases and clauses, and also teaches students sort of the flexibility of where can we place these phrases and clauses. Sometimes they do need to go in a specific spot in a sentence, but sometimes you might place this subordinate clause at the beginning or the end of a sentence, depending on what kind of effect you're trying to create. So those are some specific suggestions for instruction. We also really drew on an excellent article by Mesmer and Rose McCauley from The Reading Teacher, published in 2018. This article is entitled A Closer Look at Close Reading, 3 Under-the-Radar Skills Needed to Comprehend Sentences. And this is one that we actually used with our teachers in this professional learning inquiry to help sort of develop their own awareness of how sentences work and to give them some really concrete practices that they could use. So that included things like annotation, using annotation to track anaphoric references, teaching connective functions explicitly. So Diana talked about those different functions of connectives, like temporal, adversative, right? So actually helping students develop awareness of the different functions, you can do that with like a word sort. Give them the different functions and then ask them to sort the connective words into those. And then things like sentence expansion. So asking students to maybe practice with a positive phrases by asking them to expand on a noun or noun phrase within a sentence. And of course, all of this is really good practice that we then really want to make sure is applied within the context of what students are actually reading and writing.
Fantastic. This has been a great conversation. I've learned a lot from reading your research, and I look forward to reading more in the future. Just to wrap up, what are you each optimistic about with the direction of literacy research and instruction?
I'm optimistic about teachers. I'm optimistic about teachers' expertise and energy, and that anything we do in the research space needs to be in partnership with teachers, because they're the experts of their classrooms, their students, the systems they work in, their curriculum, their content. So there's a lot of neat ideas out there, but it's collaborating with teachers who are ready to try these things out that I think that's where the real power is. And I think that's how we move forward as a field.
Yeah, I want to echo that as well. This partnership between teachers and literacy researchers that are engaged in a wide variety of literacy research, particularly Diana and I's area has focused on adolescent literacy, which syntactic awareness and instruction is important for all grade levels, but also is particularly important for those upper elementary and secondary students. And so I'm always thinking about adolescents and thinking about how this applies to them. And there's just so many great literacy researchers and adolescent literacy educators that are working together in partnerships to further this work and really drawing on students' strengths and their identities. And I'm really excited about those partnerships that are happening. I know that you have talked to so many great literacy researchers on this podcast, so it's such a pleasure to be part of this with them as well. So thank you for having us.
Soon to be Dr. Rachel Kinnick and Dr. Dana Townsend, thanks for joining us on the Teaching Literacy Podcast.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you so much.
A big thanks to Dr. Rachel Kinnick and Dr. Diana Townsend for joining us on the Teaching Literacy Podcast. Syntax seems to be such a hot topic, and they did a fantastic job of walking us through it, what it is, and why it's a really big deal. Here's my big takeaway on the conversation. After we recorded the episode and I went back through and listened to myself read the paragraph on ancient Egypt, and I will tell you, I was not impressed with how I did. I was reading slow. I was reading choppy. I didn't layer on any expression. It just was not a stellar reading of that paragraph. And when I read that, I remember, and when I listened to myself reading it, I remember in that experience when we were recording, I was really focused on the reading, on getting the names correctly that I'd been practicing. I was really focusing a lot on just getting the words off the page. And I'm not sure I could have really summarized very well what the paragraph was talking about when we were done reading it. And that was a sixth grade text. So in that moment, when I was listening to myself reading the paragraph, I felt a lot of sympathy for our students. Maybe sympathy is not quite the correct word, but wow, we are expecting our students every single day to do things that are really, really challenging and to do things that are stretching them and pulling them. And I hope that helps us feel within ourselves that we need to be able to rise to the occasion to help our students harvest text better and really leverage the meaning from it. So in our conversation, Dr. Townsend mentioned this, and maybe we should have expounded a bit more upon it in hindsight, but she talked about how the cognitive burden to being able to process text can become cumulative, that being able to track anaphora, connectives, and appositives across a paragraph is going to be more tricky if you are also lacking background knowledge in what you're reading. If also you're lacking the skill to read the words accurately and smoothly, if you're also lacking the ability to read the text at a fluency level accurately and smoothly. So I want to connect this to a minute to Scarborough's Rope. The Rope's been super popular the last few years, and I don't necessarily have an issue with that. I think it does a great job of displaying the individual components of successful reading, and I actually think it's brought a ton of awareness around syntax and has brought syntax to a much broader audience. But one limitation of the Rope is that it doesn't actually really teach how those individual threads work together to actually become a rope, that there's actually a weaving or a threading process where the threads become a rope. There is this component of teaching the individual strands explicitly, but us as teachers, it's our job to be able to weave those together to make meaning. So for me to do a really nice job in that text, I would have needed some background and vocabulary knowledge to get me up and off the ground and running. I would have needed some multisyllabic support to be able to read those words accurately. And I probably would have needed some practice reading and rereading the passage just to make sure that I had it fluent and I had a good feel for the passage. But then I also would have definitely needed some support with syntax and anaphora and connectives and positives, because that one paragraph was so rich with all of those. And that would help me track the ideas across the paragraph. But I also would have needed some support at the text level with text structure and how the text was organized. And then I probably would have needed to have read other related texts and then actually write about ancient Egypt in an effort to sort of synthesize information across texts and be able to build knowledge that I could retain. And I'm sure what I just provided isn't an exhaustive list, but really that's a pretty good list of ingredients that I would need as a reader to harvest as much meaning from that text as possible. So on the one hand, there's a lot of pedagogy there in each of those areas to make that happen and to make it happen in a way that is efficient so that we're not spending, you know, 5 weeks on a single text unnecessarily. But on the other hand, it paints for us a clear target of saying that, you know, me as the teacher, I have a lot of influence over how my students understand text. And we did a deep dive here today on syntax. But I think the way that our guests laid it out for us today, if I were to go into a classroom tomorrow, I would think, okay, anaphora, connectives, and appositives. I can do that. I can see where there's anaphora, connectives, and appositives that are really influencing key paragraphs of the text. And I can help make those clear to my students so that they can also then benefit from understanding that text. So I hope you can take the information that was talked about today, take it in stride, and be able to really incorporate it into your instruction, because it is so important. Sentences do make up the backbone of a text. All right, that is all I have for you today. If you enjoyed this episode, the best thing you can do for the show is to share it with a friend or colleague. And if you haven't yet, I'd appreciate your review of the show wherever you find this content. This is Jake with the Teaching Literacy Podcast, and until next time, let's go and teach reading and writing and sentences just a little bit better.